Welcome to the Times of Israel's daily briefing. Today's Thursday, April 11th, day 188 of the war with Hamas. Amanda Borshel, Dan here in our Jerusalem office, joined by our legal reporter Jeremy Sharon and health reporter Renee Gert Zand. Hello to you both.
Hi, Amanda.
Good morning, Amanda.
We'll hear about a High Court of Justice petition from Israeli NGOs asking to flood Gaza with humanitarian aid. We'll also learn about a court case from Canadian citizens who lost children in the October 7th massacre. Renee is here and will tell us about invisible brain injuries and how a former Yom Kippur prisoner of war is dealing with his trauma. All this and much, much more when we're back.
The Technion Israel Institute of Technology is where some of Israel's brightest minds ask the biggest question of all. What if? What if they could take on the world's biggest challenges? What if they could develop life-changing environmental, scientific, health, medical, and technological discoveries that will make a huge impact on Israel and the planet? But they don't just ask the question, they answer it too. They turn those ideas into reality. They make them happen. To see just some of the incredible things they've achieved, get the Technion Booklet of Wonders at ats.org/wonders. We hope it inspires you to give them your support so they can keep doing what they do best. The American Technion Society. World-changing discoveries by Israel's brightest minds, made possible by you.
First, some headlines. Palestinian media outlets report a series of Israeli airstrikes and artillery shelling in central Gaza's Nusayrat since last night. In one incident, at least two people were killed in a strike on a residential tower in the area, the reports say. The IDF has not yet commented on the events. On Wednesday, Israel killed three sons of Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh in a strike in the northern Gaza Strip, saying they were operatives in the terror group. Four of Haniyeh's grandchildren, three boys and a girl, were also killed in the attack, Hamas said. The IDF and Shin Bet later confirmed killing the three men, saying they were operatives in the terror group. According to the IDF and Shin Bet, Amir Haniyeh was a squad commander in the Hamas military wing, while Hazam and Mohammed Haniyeh were lower-ranking operatives, also in the military wing. The United States believes a major Iranian attack on Israel is imminent and could happen in the coming days. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, in a call with Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, made clear that the United States will stand with Israel against any threats by Iran, the State Department says. Jeremy, Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said yesterday that Israel will open a new land crossing into the Gaza Strip designed mainly to facilitate deliveries to Palestinians of aid from overseas or from neighboring Jordan. The new entry point appears to come instead of reopening the Erez crossing in northern Gaza, which was, of course, significantly damaged on October 7th, and where many Israelis were killed and abducted, we must say. You've been working on a High Court of Justice petition from Israeli NGOs that would go much further than just opening up another crossing to bring humanitarian aid into the Strip. So first of all, tell us who these organizations are and what are they asking for?
So the main organization is called Gisha. It's a human rights and civil rights organization, which originally was kind of focused on the freedom of movement issue for Palestinians, but has expanded its brief. And Gisha, together with, Physicians for Human Rights and several other organizations, filed this petition a couple of months ago, basically demanding that Israel allow unfettered access to Gaza for humanitarian aid, and arguing, claiming that unlike what Israeli officials say, that there is no limit on the amount of humanitarian aid which can go in and on humanitarian, you know, aid distribution efforts. The petition argued that Israel was hindering this effort to a certain extent or to a large extent, and wanted the court to order the government to allow complete unhindered access for humanitarian aid and the supply effort. And it also specifically pointed to the ruling by the International Court of Justice in January, which issued several provisional measures against Israel, including specifically demanding that it increase humanitarian aid in order to alleviate the humanitarian situation in Gaza, which in January was, dire, and since then has become even worse.
So obviously this petition came before the telephone call on Thursday of last week between President Joe Biden and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. And since that phone call, there have been promises and even actions really opening up the humanitarian aid effort. We're seeing numbers of upwards of 400 trucks getting into the Strip. Do you see that the High Court of Justice is going to take all of that into consideration before ruling in this petition?
I think the court will likely mention and take into consideration those measures which Israel has said it is going to take. And in fact, the petition itself demanded that specifically that Israel allow the port of Ashdod to be used to bring in humanitarian supplies instead of the port of Said in Egypt, which is 200 kilometers away, whereas Ashdod is just 30 kilometers away. And it demanded that Erez be open, and it demanded Crossing 96 be opened. And those are the specific requests. And following that conversation which Biden had with Netanyahu, which was particularly tense, and in which Biden made, really quite strong remarks about stopping support for Israel if the humanitarian situation is not addressed, Israel then immediately adopted said it would adopt a lot of those measures which were demanded in this petition itself. So obviously the court will want to see how that plays out. And Gishah, the main petitioning organization, has said that it is very insistent that despite what Israel has said, it wants a ruling from the court so that there is a legal process following the developments and following the declarations by the Israeli government and to make sure that the government follows through. But as you said, as we mentioned, several of the demands of the petition, Israel has already said now, following that conversation, that it will comply with. One does have to say that given that before the conversation between Biden and Netanyahu, between 150 to 200 trucks were going in a day on average, Israel was saying there was no limit on the amount of aid that could go in. Now, all of a sudden, Israel is saying that 400 plus trucks are going in a day. So it's slightly not quite understandable how that situation has developed. The one other issue which the Gishah petition mentioned and which several NGOs operating in Gaza have mentioned is that it's not just the issue of getting the aid across the border from the Israel side to the Gazan side. Organizations have talked about the problem of distributing the aid inside Gaza. One organization in particular mentioned that many, many requests to COGAT, that's the Israeli agency which coordinates humanitarian affairs in Gaza, it said that COGAT has refused numerous requests to coordinate the delivery or the collection of that aid and to deliver it inside Gaza, particularly northern Gaza, where there are 300,000 people. And that's where the humanitarian situation is the most dire. That's where there is reports of severe malnutrition and hunger amongst the Palestinian population there. So it's not just about, as I said, getting the aid in. It's about allowing conditions where that can be distributed.
One point on the petition that I found very interesting is that it calls for unlimited and unfettered movement of staff, if I'm not mistaken, into the Strip. So who would these staff be? Would that be the IDF, or would it be these NGOs themselves who want to enter the Gaza Strip, or some international organizations in order to distribute the aid more widely?
Well, I think they are talking about the staff of the humanitarian aid organizations and the NGOs. And the petition says that these people have got a lot of, it's very difficult for them to, for some of them, it's difficult to gain access. Their efforts to gain access and provide up-to-date reports on the humanitarian situation is not always, and in fact, often not granted. But the petition also actually demands, it says that Israel is now occupying Gaza in the legal sense of the word, and therefore has responsibilities to the Gazan population. And therefore, the petition also demands that the court order Israel to take control and responsibility for the distribution of aid, which is something obviously which Israel has refused to do. And I find it difficult to believe that the court would take, would adopt and accept that request. But it is worth noting that that is a significant part of the petition.
Any sense on the timeline of this ruling?
Right. So the state was meant to provide the court with additional information by yesterday so that the court could then make a decision on whether to issue the orders requested by the petitioners. Yesterday, the state requested another 5 days to provide all the accurate information, saying it didn't have enough time to get all the information together. And actually, the court hasn't got replied yet as to whether it will allow the state another 5 days. But Guichard said it's utterly opposed to that because it said there's a massive humanitarian crisis and why should it take another 5 days to get the information together? So I expect the court to tell the state today whether it'll give it that extra time to provide the information. But given the humanitarian situation, which the justices during the hearing last week were fully aware of and expressed concern over, I don't imagine the court will give the state too much longer to provide the information it's asked for.
Please check out the website for more updates on this. Let's turn to Canada, where constant listeners of the Daily Briefing know that I grew up from my accent and where Renee as well is from. And a group of Canadian citizens and residents whose children and parents were murdered by Hamas during the October 7th atrocities has filed an application to the Canadian federal court, to the country's attorney general, demanding the annulment of the Canadian government's decision in March to resume funding to UNRWA, which is, of course, the UN agency that provides humanitarian aid to Palestinians. Jeremy, where does this case stand as well?
So the suit, which was filed by the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs in Canada, and as you mentioned, the close relatives, the parents and children of some of the people who were murdered on October 7th, that was only filed last week. So there hasn't been too much developments in terms of progressing with that suit. But I think it is an important step, and the petition, the application, raises some serious issues for the Canadian government, in that it points out that under Canadian law, and specifically there's an act called the Department of Foreign Affairs Trade and Development Act and the Official Development Assistance Accountability Act. Under those laws, the humanitarian assistance or foreign aid provided by Canada must be in line with Canadian values and also international human rights standards. Both those phrases are mentioned explicitly in those two pieces of law. So what the application mentioned is that, back in January, I think it was, there was a series of reports about the complicity of a small number of UNRWA staff in the actual attacks on October 7th. Israel, I think Defense Minister Gallant said 12 UNRWA staff participated directly in the attacks. Another 30 helped take hostages and looted Israeli communities. Then another 12% of UNRWA's 13,000 staff, according to Gallant, have membership or are closely associated with Hamas. And several hundred of those were even members in the military branches of Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Then also you have to remember the numerous reports going back years and years and years of incitement to anti-Semitism and glorification of terrorism in the education provided in UNRWA schools, which teach a large proportion of Gazan children. And other reports, such as the fact that a massive Hamas data center was found in a bunker underneath UNRWA's headquarters in Gaza, in Gaza City. So the application said, this organization is involved in terrorist acts. Its members, large numbers of its members, are part of a terrorist organization, Hamas, and it is kind of compromised in a very serious way in terms of the values it promotes, the education it's providing, which is a central part of its mandate. The claim is that the resumption of funding under these circumstances is violating these laws. So I think there is definitely a case to answer for the Canadian government and the Minister of International Development regarding these claims.
Jeremy, thank you so much for all these updates and insights. We're going to let you go back to your very busy day now and say goodbye.
Thanks, Amanda.
We'll go to a short break.
I got married this Monday, in the middle of a war. You are not a soldier anymore. You are 50 years old. What is the matter with you?
It's like a couple of kilometers from here. Like, my friend has a 4x4. Let's just go cut across the fields and go get him.
Israel Stories, Wartime Diaries. Voices that try to capture slivers of life right now.
And he told me, take with you a sleeping bag and a tent and just go.
I texted him after I was told that he was killed.
From their eyes, I was a traitor.
Everybody needs their blankie, their teddy bear, something to make them feel safe.
I'm just another grandfather looking after his grandchild while his son is off at war.
These children of Hamas now will be the killer of my children.
I desperately wanted to talk about sex during my eulogy for Ido.
Everyone has to choose to be optimistic because we don't have room for pessimism.
Check out Israel Story wherever you get your podcasts.
Renee, thanks for staying with me. You recently met up with Dr. Raquel Gardner, who is the director of clinical research of the Joseph Segal Neurocenter at Sheba Medical Center. And she talked to you about something that we're calling an invisible brain injury, which is traumatic brain injury, TBI. Tell us a little bit about what TBI is and how it was discovered to be afflicting U.S. troops.
Right. So Dr. Gardner is trying to bring attention here in Israel to TBI, to invisible brain injuries. And it's really important because, of course, all the attention is going now to visible injuries or life-threatening injuries coming in among the troops. But she she's a recent immigrant and has brought her expertise in traumatic brain injury, which she has gained over the years working on, studying the U.S. military since the global war on terror began. And she's also done studies on American football players and treated these players who also suffer from these injuries. So traumatic brain injury occurs when there is an exposure to the head. So it can be a hit. It can be an acceleration or deceleration, sort of a sudden movement or shaking, or it can be a blast wave that hits the body, hits the head, and goes through the brain. So those are the three possibilities to start with. And then if there are no symptoms felt, then we call that a subconcussive event. But if there are symptoms, and there are certain symptoms that doctors look for, then that is called a TBI, a traumatic brain injury. And many people know this as a concussion. We talk about concussions, but they are actually TBIs. And what I was really surprised to hear is that most of these do not show up on CT scans. Most of them do not involve bleeding in the brain. So it's very hard to make a clear diagnosis. The doctors are still trying to figure out, what are the short-term and long-term effects of these injuries. There remains the question of how many low-level blasts are too many and lead to really permanent effects. So at Sheba, Dr. Gardner is leading a couple of initiatives. One is they're using a screening tool with all the soldiers in the rehabilitation department to determine whether they indeed suffered a TBI, and then they can better treat them and educate them on how to help themselves recover. For instance, sleep is essential to recovery. Dr. Gardner was able to bring over a blood test that she had been party to developing through her research in the United States, which helps detect, this blood test helps detect TBI. There was the company that produces it, Abbott, was not planning to send it to the Middle East, to market it to the Middle East, but Dr. Gardner was able to convince them. And so this blood test is important not only in diagnosing TBI, but also in differentiating between TBI and PTSD, because many soldiers have both, because their injury happens in such a stressful battle situation that it's hard for doctors to pick apart whether they're suffering, you know, from one or the other or both. So the blood test can help with that. And, you know, really what she's trying to do is raise awareness of this and to try to find it, some champions among the medical community here to bring this, to take this forward with her.
So in the theme of PTSD, you met a survivor of 8 months of Syrian captivity in 1973. His name is Amnon Sharon. You met him at Beit HaLochem, which we've discussed previously on the podcast. And it's interesting how his trauma is being expressed in ceramics, in art. So tell us very briefly about his captivity and how he is expressing it today.
Yeah, he's really an amazing guy, really, really warm. And it was wonderful to spend quite a bit of time with him. Amnon was a young tank officer in reserve duty during the Yom Kippur War. And on the first day of the war in October 1973, he was captured by the Syrians on the Golan Heights. And he was taken immediately as a prisoner of war to Damascus, where he was imprisoned. He was in solitary confinement for months. He was horribly tortured. And he told me about how he survived that. He used visualization and active imagination, which he didn't know the terms for this, of course, at the time, but he used that to get through, to visualize what it would be like to get out of this situation, to come up with imaginary scenes in his head so he wouldn't feel the pain. And now he gives motivational speeches about this and helps others. He's still suffering from PTSD. He's suffering the physical effects of his torture, but he has moved on with life. And one way that he deals with in recent years in which he has handled his PTSD is by expressing, by basically recreating what the scenes were in prison in Damascus through these clay figurines, these clay sculptures he makes, which are on display at Beit HaLochem. They are in many ways hard to look at, to see. They are just horrific scenes, but you also learn from them how strong he was to survive those situations.
Truly, such an example of resilience. Words cannot express it. I will, of course, put a link to that story in our program notes. Renee, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. Please check out another installment tomorrow. This episode was produced by The Podwaves. If you have any comments or questions about this or any other episode, please drop us an email to podcast@timesofisrael.com. Until tomorrow, shalom.